Today is Friday, July 17th, 2009. This is Susan Resnick. Today we're at San Diego State University to interview Dr. Alan W. Anderson. This interview is funded by the John and Jane Adams Mini Grant for the Humanities. Dr. Anderson, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies, academic background includes philosophy, comparative religion, and literature, which he studied at Columbia University. He has taught philosophy and religion for 23 years at San Diego State University, and beginning in 1969, he was involved in the establishment of the Department of Religious Studies. In 1970, he was awarded the California State Distinguished Teacher Award. In 1975, between January and April, he conducted 18 one-hour dialogues with J. Krishnamurti entitled A Wholly Different Way. Professor Anderson is a scholar, a teacher, and a poet. And to quote something I read, it says, accomplished academically, his soul is that of a poet. His pen and mind are happiest in verse. Well, I'd like to say good morning to you and also to your colleagues, Mary Hicklin and Bruce Hansen. Good morning, Dr. Anderson.
Oh, good morning, Dr. Resnick.
Let's start out by going right to San Diego State University, and then we can go on your journey. This is your oral history and your journey, and you can go backwards, forwards, wherever you want to take us. How did you happen to come to teach at San Diego State University? And by the way, I want to mention to you something I didn't mention before. I make notes of certain proper names and expressions because when we have a transcriber who will be taking this interview, it helps her to know what the terms are if I write them out for her. So that's what
Splendid.
I'm doing. Okay. So how did you come to San Diego State?
I was invited to apply. And I accepted the invitation. I was living in New York at the time, just across the street from Columbia University.
I know it well.
You know it well.
Yes. What inspired you to say, okay, I'll go out west?
I wanted to come to California.
Uh-huh. And when you came here, what did you discover in this setting? I mean, also, of course, what years are we talking about now?
Well, let's see. I came here in 62.
Okay, so it was the 60s, which was, of course, an interesting time. And an interesting time in California in particular, I would think. So that must. So apparently that appealed to you to come to California.
It reminds me of the Chinese best wishes. May you live in interesting times.
Ah, yes. And clearly you have, and we all are. So when you came here, who interviewed you? What happened?
I don't recall being interviewed on coming here.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Nothing dramatic. I just arrived.
And and you began to teach in the philosophy department?
Yes.
Okay. And you brought with you, from what I understand in reading about your academic background up to that point, combination of literature and philosophy and religion and whatever else you bring. And so did you enjoy teaching here when you started out? I mean, did it?
I've always enjoyed teaching.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk a little bit about how you view the role of a teacher? I know that you touched on this in your fourth dialogue with Krishnamurti. He touched on it, and you kind of shaped what he was saying about the role of the teacher and the student. Would you like to talk a little about that?
Yes, I have a rather strong conviction that teaching in a strict sense doesn't really come to pass unless the student and the teacher operate together.
Mm-hmm.
The virtual classical role where the teacher talks and unfortunately many times down to the student is not, strictly speaking, teaching. It's just a species of announcing.
Mm-hmm. So did you start to teach in any different way than other people were teaching here, or do you know?
Well, I never attended any of their classes, so uh-huh. there's no way that I could compare.
Uh-huh. But apparently you must have been doing something to receive the Outstanding Teacher Award, and I also was reading comments at the tribute to you from George Gross and other professors talking about how really special you have been as a teacher and as a colleague, so, and inspiring. So tell me about the department, because you must, when it started, it was 1969, and you must have nurtured it in certain ways.
No, it really started from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't been set up. How it came about
mm-hmm.
Was simply that it seemed to some of us in the philosophy department
mm-hmm.
that it would be helpful to the university's program as a whole to have another department mm-hmm. called the Department of Religious Studies.
Mm-hmm. And by the Department of Religious Studies, can you elaborate a little more? Comparative religions, I know that I've heard reference to the Eastern religions that you're so involved with. Did you tell me a little bit more about it? Because I think that it may be different than other departments of religious studies, from what I recall hearing.
Really?
I'm
very interested
or
to hear
different
that.
Your own approach to religious studies versus the historical or approach is there?
Well, it seems to me that that question goes to the heart of what underlies the activity
right.
of religious studies, and I think what underlies it is essentially self-inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And that is what underlies it is the essence of what this department really was about, in other words.
It was my hope.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that it pretty happy about the way it was received, or the students? Clearly you've had students who feel they benefit very much from this approach.
Well, let's ask them.
Okay.
They were both there.
We have, as I mentioned, we are welcoming both Mary and Bruce, and this could be a little, it's okay.
That's wonderful.
Well, Ellen, why don't you elaborate a little bit in the way you approached teaching. And you mentioned that it was if there wasn't a special relation between you and the student, then you didn't believe actual teaching was occurring. At other times, you've mentioned that you never lectured from notes. That's the case. Mm-hmm. But he's also has mentioned he never taught what he hadn't undergone, what he hadn't experienced. Why don't you talk a little about that? I think that would be interesting.
Well, I'm awfully glad Bruce mentioned what he has just pointed to in his last few remarks. I always felt that when you walk into the classroom
mm-hmm.
as a teacher,
mm-hmm.
you have an obligation to avoid simply announcing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have an obligation to sense the condition of the room. Each time you walk in, it's atmospherically different. And you had better meet that. So many times I would have a notion of what I thought would be timely.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I got inside the room, I knew it wasn't. You know how walls are atmospheric.
Mm-hmm.
So on the spot, I had to begin from scratch.
Hmm. Well, that's a very interesting approach, and I think that certainly leads to creativity in the classroom rather than just something that's previously established. Well, but the context of the time in which you were doing this was the 1960s, and there was a lot of change. And did you feel that in any way affected the topics that you were talking about? I know you were discussing scriptures and the word, and I wondered if what kind of students came in? What was it like?
Well, those were interesting days.
Yes.
Students always oversubscribed to my classes, and in those days many of them would come in and test whether they wanted to sign up to this class or not. So the room was over full, and they would be sitting down on the floor with their feet in my face, and it was a strange time.
Yes.
Bruce and Mary would be able to tell you more about it than I would, because they are closer to that generation.
Well, I was thinking today as I walked across the campus here on my way to meet you that I noticed all the students walking around in shorts. I'm thinking, this is also an interesting time, because we certainly didn't do that. So,
Ellen, you might expand a little bit on how you felt that the preparedness of the student changed around the mid-60s from when you first came on campus to around that mid-decade point.
Yes, the... You mean about 65?
Right.
I was in India in 65 and read the news that things had blown up.
Mm-hmm.
And it rather shocked me, because I had never been in an environment of that order.
Mm.
But I tried, when I got back from India, to find my way as mercifully as I could in this new age, because everybody looked upon it as a new age.
Mm-hmm.
It was not an easy time.
No.
And I must have been thought a bit of a petty tyrant, because as both Mary and Bruce will remember, I took a fairly hard line with respect to the responsibility of the student to study. I've always kept in mind St. Paul's admonition. I think it must have been in this case to Timothy: beware of those who are always seeking to learn but are incapable of becoming taught. And I tried to bring home to my students during that virtual K-12 catastrophic time, mm-hmm. what we refer to historically as the 60s.
Yes.
I tried to help the students see their responsibility for respect for the subject that they were studying.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea how much I succeeded, if at all, but Mary and Bruce might be able to show some light on that, because they studied with me.
Well, this interview isn't of us, so we're trying to get you to expand a little on the way you presented, because you were, as you say, you would demand a certain respect from the student to the subject, a certain seriousness to it. But I think you could speak a little bit more in your own approach to Scripture. Maybe you could relate that lunch you had with the various pastors and all here, and your reaction.
Yes, I'm sure you'll find this interesting.
Good.
In a lunch that I had with the campus pastors, it occurred to me that it might be timely to ask them a fundamental question. And I asked them about the Incarnation, and I quoted the first chapter of St. John's Gospel. And I asked them whether if they believed it. They didn't say a word. Now, these were campus pastors.
Mm.
Of course, it was, I suppose, not the most tactful of questions, but I wanted to know what was going on.
Uh-huh.
Well, I found out in a hurry, didn't I?
Yes.
here we have pastors.
Yes.
Whose relation to what it is that they are preaching,
mm-hmm.
is pretty wobbly.
You know?
And what does that really come to? Well, it greatly impressed me, let's say.
Well, I'm sure they were surprised at being asked.
Well.
But I think that's marvelous.
But wouldn't you characterize the response that perhaps they should have made, that yes, I believe, even if I don't yet understand what it means, that fundamental mm-hmm. Volitional trust was the stance you took to Scriptures and to your own
mm-hmm.
subject that
yes.
might have distinguished you from some colleagues?
Perhaps.
perhaps you could expand on that.
Please do go ahead.
No, I would like you to expand on that, and talk more about the approach that, based on what you were just saying, what your approach is. I've gotten some but sense of it, but when you would be speaking with the students. For example,
I always brought the issue, let's say, home. I always brought the issue home to their own opportunity for self-inquiry, by which I had any reference to psychoanalysis or, mm-hmm. or whatever. But just to start from scratch. in conferences in my office.
Mm-hmm.
I think virtually almost all students responded to that well, which was fortunate for me.
Mm-hmm.
I also promised my classes that I wouldn't bring anything forward that I hadn't undergone myself. That I wasn't just there to babble off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted them to have confidence that what I was saying was rooted in what I had undergone. I think on the whole they appreciated that, didn't they?
Oh, I would think so. Yeah.
Well, I don't think teaching occurs in any other context.
Mm-hmm.
Not genuine teaching.
Did you find some of the colleagues here, besides your meeting with the pastors, shared your sense of what you're describing and philosophically in terms of the way to teach and relate to students? Did you, over the years with colleagues here, were there any that you became close with and talked about these things with?
This is an embarrassing question. Not because you're trying to be embarrassing, but it's embarrassing to have to answer it by saying no.
Huh. Because clearly you were admired by other professors, and the tribute that they gave, it seems they admired what you were doing, and I was just wondering if, you know, that had been shared, but apparently not.
Well, admiration is a strange sentiment. One can admire what one doesn't feel one is at the time resonating with.
Yeah, true.
So I wouldn't put too much stock
in admiration. Well, but it... You nurtured this department, apparently, because it grew and expanded, and so your particular way became what made this happen. And so everything that you bring with you probably contributed to this, and I don't know whether you'd like to go back, but I'm just curious, because I find it wonderful and fascinating that you studied literature and then philosophy, and the expression in poetry, in relationship to poetry, is so central to you that I was just wondering how that, if you wish to, how you came upon this pathway leading to finally the doctorate in religion, but you started with comparative literature, and I wondered how that happened.
From a child, I had always one huge question: what is it all about? And I came, when I was going to Columbia, I came to think that I ought to read those literatures that deal with that question, and particularly the wisdom books of the Bible do that. Even in the Catholic version, which includes the Apocrypha, the attempt to deal with the wisdom tradition,
mm-hmm.
is heartily present. But unfortunately, the wisdom tradition is paid almost no attention to at all academically. The academy itself, it seems to me to be basically estranged from it.
So you focused on those literatures that related
to the wisdom,
tradition, and then I did that involve all the Eastern philosophies as well, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. My involvement with Eastern thought, Oriental thought,
mm-hmm.
Indian and Far Eastern traditions, was always within the context of the wisdom tradition.
I see. And, go ahead.
No.
I was just going to say, in the Eastern tradition, and I am not very familiar with all of this, but I will try. I've read references to the I Ching? Could you tell me about that and how it relates to this?
Well, it's the first of the Confucian classics.
Okay.
And at least for the Chinese and Japanese, it's revered, and it's also an oracle. And if you ask a question, and let us say throw the coins,
mm-hmm.
the answer will send you to a given hexagram
mm-hmm.
within the I Ching, and that gives you a reference for whatever it was that you were concerned to bring up. I often advise my students to start their day out with asking the oracle. It's counsel for their behavior for the day. And then I asked them to ask it when the day was over, to ask it for a grade, for how they made out. Many of them found that useful. Mm-hmm. Some of them still do it.
And so you mentioned the oracle, and did you also explore and teach about oracles in different cultures? And I've just tried to explore a little.
No, I didn't take an historical approach to it.
Ah, that's what you said. Okay.
But rather
okay.
an intrinsic one.
Got it. Okay. So, as the years went by at San Diego State, did you find that you changed the curriculum in different ways, or did it just evolve or pretty much stayed as it was?
I did bring with me a preconceived, predigested package.
Right.
I think it has to do with how you find yourself in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to listen to what's coming toward me.
Mm-hmm.
The future to me is not something waiting to be met out there, but rather something that comes from out there to meet me.
That's nice.
And my response to that is my responsibility.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, and I'll just say something and then we'll... I would love it if you could go back a bit and talk a little bit about the date and place of your birth and your experiences on your journey before coming to San Diego State University.
Well, I was born in New Zealand. Think of myself as half Maori. And grew up in England. Came here in 1936, that is, to the States. And came here by invitation. The Department of Philosophy wrote me and asked me to apply. And there's something rather humorous in this event, because Alan Watts wanted to become a member of the department, and they wouldn't have him because he didn't have a doctorate.
Ah.
Which struck me as a little far-fetched. But, you know, even Union Theological Seminary has Reinhold Niebuhr, who doesn't have a doctorate either.
Uh-huh.
So, to make that the hallmark of whether you shape up or not, it seemed to me a little extravagant. But, well, I'm not administratively prone, so I won't say any more about it.
Well, before all of that, you mentioned, you know, being born in New Zealand and then going to England. Did you stay in England? You said you came here in 1936.
I was born in 1922.
Yes. And did you live in New York City, or...?
No, I lived in a suburb of Washington, D.C.
Oh.
And it was a happiness for me because I had the Library of Congress available.
Oh, marvelous.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
And I decided that I'd do a little research, because I had always, and still do, deeply admired the Gettysburg Address. And it occurred to me, why don't you check out speeches and see after the Gettysburg Address whether they reflect any comparable greatness. So I did. I was shocked. What I read was dreadful.
Uh-huh.
Awful. And I said to myself, how can you open your mouth after the Gettysburg Address and come on with this rubbish? Isn't it amazing?
Well, the Gettysburg Address is spectacular, yeah.
Yes, I'm not suggesting that they come up to that standard.
Yeah.
But don't fall so far below it that it's a shock. It's a shock. Yeah.
And do you attribute that decline in the word, the use of language, to a decline in the culture after the Civil War, or some other cause?
I've often wondered that. That's a first-class question.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wondered about that. Mm-hmm. I remember... late 30s or 40, early 40s, Senator Dirksen, do you remember?
Everett Dirksen.
Everett Dirksen?
Yes.
He could speak. When he opened his mouth, he had something to say, and he said it beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
The other one was the Southerner Alvin Barclay.
Oh, yes.
When he opened his mouth, he had something to say, and he said it beautifully. That wraps up Congress. Isn't that dreadful?
Nothing else.
No. One of the things that interested me very much when I first came to the States was the relative lack of expectancy on the part of the public.
Mm-hmm.
Expectancy in, let's call it hope, that those who are running for office would at least be capable of using language in a manner that this is going too far, I know, but hopefully edified, but if not, most likely not, at least showed some cultivation. No. Just, no. Uh-huh. Isn't it amazing?
I think about things like that as well. I think that there's, well, perhaps, I don't know if this has struck you, but sometimes there's an admiration for people that aren't that well-educated. I mean, I can remember people stressing how they were afraid that Adlai Stevenson was too educated or whatever. I mean, you know, or his language was...
Undemocratic.
Exactly. So...
Yes, yes.
I think that we ran into that with this recent election, actually. Do you? with the recent election.
Yes.
Now.
Oh, yes.
I mean...
I've wondered about not having grown up in this country.
Yes.
I've wondered about how Americans really feel about their mother tongue.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way that I could speak about that with any confidence, because I didn't grow up here. Had I been born here, maybe I could answer that question to some degree, at least.
When you studied literature as an undergraduate, did you feel that your professors were up to what you were hoping they could be?
No.
That's what I would imagine from what you're saying.
No.
Yeah.
I can't even remember one that I would have thought was a model.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was wondering. I often ask that question. I said, do you remember any teachers who were role models in your field, whether the person, you know, is a physicist or chemist or whatever? But
right.
Yeah. And I think that's very, very telling and interesting in terms of the path that you didn't stay just in English literature, per se. I mean, the words and literature were what a means to the subject that you were, the questions you were concerned with.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
But when you were at New York University, were you involved in the English department at all, or...
No. There was. I was invited to teach at what was a separate activity of the university called the Reading Institute, and when I was there, I think this was during the egregious 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it starts, as I recall, we have, let's see, I think so, NYU. Actually, both in the late 50s and in the early 60s.
Early 60s, right.
Yeah.
Yes, because I came out here in 62.
Yeah.
Right.
So what was that reading institute? What did they do there? I'm just curious.
Their program at the Reading Institute was twofold. On the one hand, students were sent there by NYU, and also even as far away as Canada, to see if they couldn't be academically rehabilitated, because they had threatened to quit going to school, and her parents, of course. And on the other hand, there were those who were already A-grade students who were concerned to become A-plus. And the Reading Institute catered to both. The first, of course, was a matter of salvation. and the second was really quite a joy, because those students meant business.
Yeah.
They took their academic work seriously and worked very, very hard.
That's nice.
And I gave them an IQ test before we started class, and at the end. And I think the average was about 15 points.
Wow.
Which, of course, knocks into a cocked hat the notion that IQ is somehow pristinely unavailable for any change whatsoever. I remember at the time thinking to myself, I was working on my doctorate at Columbia at the time, that maybe I should try writing a paper on the wobbly character of IQ. But since it wasn't really my chief interest, I didn't do it.
So you were working at NYU but studying at Columbia at the same time. I see. I didn't realize that. Oh.
And
that must have been quite a challenge to do both at the same time.
Well, the doctorate that I earned from Columbia is a joint doctorate from Columbia and Union Theological Seminary.
Right.
So I'm an alumnus of both schools.
Did you find it an enjoyable experience doing the dual doctorate?
Yes, very much.
And where is the Union Theological Seminary in relation to the campus of Columbia University?
Just across the street.
That's what I thought, yeah. Yeah, so that's not too bad.
Not too bad.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't too bad. And of course, as you know so well, Columbia has a marvelous library.
Oh, yes.
Oh, isn't that fantastic?
It is. And you know it's on the very top floor? Aha. The Oral History Project. That's where I was mentored.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's where I learned to do this.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it is a very special little wonderful collection of a research project called the Oral History Research Office. And it was founded just after World War II by the historian Alan Nevins.
Yes.
And that's where it's hidden away. Yes, yeah.
How on earth?
But it is a wonderful library.
How could I have escaped that?
Yeah.
How could I have escaped knowing
that? It was hidden.
And it
has expanded. It has expanded, I think. But I can recall going all the way up.
Right. How fascinating. No, I didn't know about
it. But the library is marvelous, and certainly a marvelous place to study.
Oh, yes, yes. I've always said New York is a dreadful place to live, climate-wise.
Oh, yes.
But a marvelous place to work in.
I share that opinion. That's why we're here. I guess, however, I didn't do it till 1994. I moved to California. I was a New York City resident for many, many years.
I see.
But that's interesting. So when you were teaching at NYU, was the program that you were involved with down in Washington Square or somewhere else?
No, Washington Square.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it seems that...
It was a very personal order of teaching in that program. The parents would be invited to come and consult and converse and so forth.
Nice.
Well, sometimes with the student present and sometimes not.
Hmm. Here, let me do that. And then I'll press stop. We shall continue after lunch. As we continue looking back to your early years, could you tell me how the owl and the pussycat affected you in a special way?
Let me see about how old I was. Excuse me. I probably was around 10.
Mm-hmm.
10, 11. After the poem had been read, I don't know what it's like over in England now, but in those days, the teacher, or as he was, or she, called the master, read The Owl and the Pussycat, because you'd hear at least one poem read a day, and you'd be sitting there scared to death that you'd be called up to recite. And the first time I heard The Owl and the Pussycat, I underwent what was tantamount to a religious conversion.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point forward, I was quite sure that The Owl and the Pussycat had described the way things really are.
Hmm.
And I accepted that. I've never changed my mind since.
Wow. That's such a defining moment.
It was a totally defining moment for me. And it was for the conventionally religious.
Mm-hmm.
It was not only defining, but catastrophic.
Hmm. I'm trying to remember the poem about the owl and the pussycat. Do you remember it?
The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money, wrapped up in a 5-pound note. The owl, he looked to the stars above and sang to a small guitar, "Oh, pussy, oh, pussy, oh, pussy, my love. What a beautiful pussy you are, you are, you are," said Puss to the owl. "You elegant fowl, how charmingly sweet you sing. Come, let us be married. Too long we have tarried. But what shall we do for a ring?" So they sailed away for a year and a day to the land where the bong tree grows. And there in a wood a piggywig stood with a ring in the end of his nose. His nose, his nose, with a ring in the end of his nose. "Dear pig, are you willing to sell for 1 shilling your ring?" said the piggy. "I will." So they hurried away and were married the next day. By the turkey who lives on the hill, they dined on mince and slices of quince, which they ate with a runcible spoon. And hand in hand on the edge of the sand, they danced by the light of the moon. The moon, the moon. They danced by the light of the moon. That's the Owl and the Pussycat.
That is beautiful.
And that, that really stamped my life. That was my religious conversion, you might say. Except it wasn't a conversion from something else. It was a brand new beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never changed. So I'm not one who could be described as having what is called among Protestants a religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the Owl and the Pussycat was, in effect, such for me.
The power of words to express something very carefully is something that I know that we want to look at from this, to jump from this to that, rather than words just being utilitarian. I think you've expressed that you have to be careful about words, and is that what you poets do more? Is that, how does that relate to?
I think a genuine poet lets the word measure him or her,
mm-hmm.
which is very different from thinking of it utilitarianly.
Mm-hmm. And.
But, of course, 99.4% of the population would have a hard job understanding that.
Alan, could I ask you, what is it in the nonsense lyrics of an Edward Lear and the Owl and the Pussycat? You just said that you felt that that poem described reality more accurately, closer to what is the case, than all the rational theologies that you
right.
had read. What is, could you expand on that a little bit? How did that nonsense verse, how do you understand that as more accurately reflecting the character of reality?
Well, the first thing that occurs, if you're seriously listening, is that it checkmates any quantitative analysis that you might like to undertake and leaves you qualitatively, if you're serious,
mm-hmm.
open
mm-hmm.
to the content of what you're listening to.
Mm.
And that's rare.
Yes.
People won't make that move. I don't know what prevents them from making that move, and there may be any number of psychological issues that psychologists would like to fool around with, but no. No. Most people don't relate to poetry that way, and certainly not to language that way. Word, they don't allow to measure them. And if you don't allow the word to measure you, this is going to sound harsh, but you haven't heard or read anything. Because you're occupying a position which St. Paul cautions. I've forgotten which of the epistles it's in, but he refers to those who are always seeking to learn, but incapable of becoming taught. I remember the first time I read that. I felt 20 pounds lighter.
In some of the Eastern philosophies that you and religious beliefs that you have studied and learned about, do they express something similar or very different about the word?
Hinduism has a lot to say about the word. I think you could say that Taoism is very sensitive to language. It used to be the case culturally that when a priest or minister stood up to deliver a sermon or a sermonette, most of them were hoping it would be it. It used to be that it was hoped, if not expected, that what they would hear would be worthwhile having come to church that day for. I don't know that that still obtains, because the attitude toward language has changed. I doubt very much whether anybody could be expected to use language the way Lincoln used it in the Gettysburg Address.
Alan, in relation to her question also on Asian religions, how would you understand the Confucian doctrine of rectification of names? Would that fit in with what you're saying now?
But that's a difficult question. I think Confucius perhaps had at least in mind that carelessness with language ought to stop. What he meant beyond that, I can't be sure.
When he gives us an example of it, that were a father to be a true father, a son a true son, then the words would be rectified in practice,
yes,
as opposed to simply
right.
Spoken. And wouldn't you agree that what you said earlier about measuring up to the word, a man could fail to measure up to the name father,
as
a son could fail to measure up to the name son?
Right.
Could you speak a little on that?
Well, I think culturally speaking, we've reached an abyss with respect to the relation to language. I'm reminded of St. Paul's caution. Beware of those who are always seeking to learn, but incapable of becoming taught. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that anything could be done about that condition, the incapacity to become taught. It's odd, isn't it, that on the one hand, from the perspective of desire, they're always seeking to learn. But from the perspective of readiness to become taught, they're not ready.
Mm. Would you see that referring, the beginning problem there, do you think is touched upon when you mentioned the Owl and the Pussycat, how its first effect is to stop the rational assumption and to wait upon what is to be revealed?
Yes.
And so what they're unwilling to do is to drop their preconception
and
be informed, if you will, in a way that would change and raise them.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're not living in a culture that values its mother tongue.
Could you maybe take the 23rd Psalm? It's a psalm you love, isn't it?
Yes.
And sort of, could you recite that from memory and then sort of show us how you would understand that psalm at the level that you're referring to here, where we stop projecting an understanding or reading in some theology on the Lamb, if you will, and how we would be informed by the psalm. Can you remember that psalm?
Oh yes. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Marvelous. It is such an utterance. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. I think it's the case, isn't it, that sheep will not drink from running water. He leadeth me beside the still waters. Excuse me. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. It's a marvelous statement, because it includes chastisement, rod, and a staff, comfort. Marvelous statement. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Mm-hmm. And then this beautiful line, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. It's a beautiful.
That's beautiful.
Beautiful psalm.
That's so beautiful.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And if you can listen to that with the heart open, It's such a beautiful and medicinal statement that it has an effect.
Yeah, I have always felt that.
Have you?
Yes.
Yes, well, I can understand that. So have I.
Yes.
I
love it.
It's healing.
Very much. Yeah.
Right.
That was a good idea. Yeah.
How marvelous. You know, I had no idea that it would be so pleasant.
I'm so glad. I think that I would really enjoy you sharing with us the children's poetry in the book. Tell us about your book, because that would be a treat also.
You mean here?
Yes. Would you tell us songs from, am I pronouncing it correctly, the Mifflinger or Mifflinger?
Mifflinger.
Mifflinger. C. And A Little Cove of Nonsense by Alan W. Anderson. And it's a beautiful cover, which I hear you found the artist, Bruce.
The illustrator.
The illustrator.
Right, but I have
Leslie,
to take no credit for her
Rhea
skills.
Lewis. It's such a beautiful cover. It's with the rainbows and the lavender, and it just makes you feel happy looking at it, I think. And is there something in here that you could share with us?
You know it. You know the poetry better.
Would you like to choose something?
Why don't you? I'm looking forward to reading the whole thing after, Mary.
Ina or Hannah?
I was thinking Hannah, yeah.
Hannah? That was my mother's name.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's read that for her then, if that was her mother's name.
Hannah.
Yeah. Here's the illustration for it, too.
Oh, let me see. Oh, the illustrations are wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, please read it.
Hannah. The flowers of Karadina, like the birds of Trenacore, recall the clouds of Hana, her caverns and her shore. Mm-hmm. Her caverns and her shoreline sea change, the lost and blown. A melt, a brew of mist wine arises, heaven's own. Birth bold the clouds of Hana, break water and outpour the flowers of Karadina, the birds of Trenacore.
It's beautiful. Just beautiful.
Oh, I'm so glad you like it.
I do.
Thank you.
Oh, and the illustrations. Are there any others you'd like to share?
Well, anything you choose, I'll be happy to read.
Why don't you read the Mifflinger Sea, since it's the title poem, and
that
maybe you can explain a little your form of nonsense as descriptive, and if you care to relate it back to Alan the Pussycat or nonsense generally, would that be something you might want to do?
Fine.
Okay, here's the Mifflinger Sea. That would be good.
By the sea, by the ancient Mifflinger Sea, where the whale and the herring sport amiably, let us go down, down over the lea, to the emerald waters of the Mifflinger Sea. Great gentle beasts romp the night sand, chasing the line between water and land, while exquisite peacocks in step 3x3, watch pompously down by the Mifflinger Sea. Tiny blue shells glow on the shore like shimmering moons, and some cup the door to intricate passages used by strange wee inhabitants of the Mifflinger Sea. I have recently come from this ocean whose vast waters encompass all future, all past. They draw from a stream whose deeps ever remain the font of our pleasure, the ebb of our pain. Mm-hmm. By the sea, by the ancient Mifflinger Sea, where the whale and the herring sport amiably, let us go down, down over the lea, to the emerald waters of the Mifflinger Sea.
It's beautiful. It's lovely. It's charming. Do you paint or draw at all?
Oh, once in a while, I paint.
You paint such beautiful pictures with words that I was wondering.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. I like to mix ink and watercolor. Mm-hmm. The relation between those two media fascinates me. Ink has a much harder edge than water.
Mm-hmm.
But if you gentle them, if you bring them together, the effect is better than either.
I just thought that might be the case.
The parable of the sword.
The parable of the sword. Okay, I will. Let's do it. Back again to the relationship to scriptures. I've heard that you had a very unique way of expressing this. Could you talk about that with the parable of the sword?
Sower.
Thank you.
How did you interpret the parable of the sower and apply it to that inward self-inquiry? How did you see the different? How did you interpret the seed landing on the different terrain in relation to the different temperaments in relation to receiving the word?
Yes. Each of us, individually speaking, have a qualified difference. Before scripture itself, the whole issue of openness, you might say, gapes before that issue. What does it mean to be in a state of readiness to hear and read scripture? What is required of the reader and hearer of scripture, so that it cannot be said of them that they have ears to hear but don't hear, and eyes to see and don't see? On the contrary, they have ears to hear and listen, and eyes to see and look and perceive. What is that all about? There's the difficulty of being capable of becoming taught, which is an inward condition that you cannot presume everyone who enters the classroom is coming in with it. No. I was always impressed with the atmospheric of a classroom. It was never, ever repetitive. Every time I walked into the room, it was for the first time. And sometimes I'd have in mind something that I thought would be timely to bring forward. And as soon as I put my foot in the door, I said, drop it. And we take off from here. So I never used any notes. My notion of teaching is not that it is a species of announcing, but I know that I'm not in the company of a large number with that view. But I can't understand it in any other way if we're talking about teaching. The difficulty with teaching and learning is that on the one hand, there are those who are always seeking to learn, but there are those who, while seeking to learn, remain incapable of becoming taught. That sounds pretty un-American, I know, because it has a hierarchical sense to it. But isn't that the case? Can you think of in what sense or senses that's false? Well, we have a college professor over there who...
and he has learned from you, so...
Well, no, this isn't my history.
Right.
But, Alan, because we've kind of come around this circle a couple times, relate the... Let's go back to the parable. Let's stick to that parable of the sower. And so you can remember... The parable, right? You remember?
Yes.
Yeah. Why don't you tell the parable and then take the different terrains in which the seeds are sown and explain how those three, the first three types, are incapable of learning, even though they may very well seek to be informed. So maybe we could start and you could just tell us the parable and then let's take each step in turn. Is that...
I'm interested in it because I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah. She'd like to hear the parable.
The parable of the sower is about the way seed cast by the one who sows falls.
Oh.
On the one hand, it falls by the wayside, and the birds of the air come and gobble it up. Then it also falls among rocks and stony places, which don't give it enough soil in which to establish itself. It also falls where it's able to root itself, but unable to sustain itself. There's something terribly sad about that, at least to me. But there's also where the seed falls on what is called good ground. And there it establishes itself and flourishes. If I haven't misunderstood what Jesus was trying to teach, what is described in that parable of the sower. Is states of readiness.
Mm-hmm.
And to be really ready is fairly rare. It's a pity, but there is the condition of seeking to learn, but being incapable of becoming taught.
Would you relate that to seed cast on rocky ground then? Is that what the one in the parable that you would...
Well, you could take it even farther and say, where it also falls simply by the wayside, where there's virtually no soil at all. Dreadful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I always had the feeling, whereas my classes mercifully, I think, mostly paid attention when I spoke.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to think maybe no more than 3% of them really grasped what I was driving at.
But even if you reached 3%, I think that's...
not too bad.
That's not bad. Really.
But Bruce, for instance, and Mary both shining examples.
That's what I was just thinking, just exactly that. But here they are. I mean, clearly... you touch them and reach them, and here they are.
Well, many students, the illustrations you admire were from one of his students. He had another, Howard Mueller, who taught here for several years in the philosophy and religion department. Many.
So the seeds that you sowed, some flourished.
Although mine were... my life might be better described as the one that comes up with all the thickets, the seeds that fall with all the thickets and thorns, and to fight through
that. He's pulling our legs. No. Bruce and Mary both are the rare examples of true seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very rare.
I feel that. I can see that.
Yeah.
That's marvelous.
Oh, it is marvelous. To me, it's an enormous nourishment.
Well, it looks like it's a mutual nourishment.
You know.
Go ahead.
No.
Can you share some other something like that? I'll just say that. Continuing to think about particularly pivotal or salient moments in your life, can you share any other?
Yes, let us stay with this violin story.
Could you tell the story for her though, because she didn't have the tape on
when
so just tell the story.
My father, this is about an event in England.
Okay.
My father had just come back from Switzerland, and he brought with him a violin that a young man had given him to sell for him, for the young man, because he knew that my father was very well known among merchants of musical instruments and whatnot. My father was a very fine musician.
Oh.
And his father before him. His father before him, when the poor baby was still in the crib, had to sleep with his fingers pried apart with corks so that he would be able to reach, as he continued growing older, tenths,
huh,
instead of just the octave. But my father brought this violin back from Switzerland for this chap who wanted my father to sell it. And I asked my father to buy it for me because I played it, and it had such a beautiful tone. I know that a master craftsman doesn't complain about his tools, but there is a difference in your tools. You know, some tools are adequate and some aren't. And no amount of all that moralization is going to make the tool better or worse. You know, it's just the case. And but my father was preoccupied with getting things together to come over here.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a day or two short of leaving England for here. And I don't know whether he heard me. But I didn't want to make a nuisance of myself, so I didn't ask him again. I just left it alone. But I don't think I was ever meant to spend most of my life in music, in any case. So something deep in me was not put off by his apparent uninterest in my concern. He was altogether preoccupied with finishing up, packing and all the rest of it to come over here. But that was a case of a pivotal moment in my development.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he had bought that violin for me,
yes,
I would have practiced my head right off, because it was such a lovely instrument, beautiful violin. But I don't think I was ever, with reference to the higher governance, I don't think that I was ever meant to have it.
Mm-hmm.
I was never meant to spend my life primarily as a musician anyway. So, everything worked out.
Everything apparently did work out. And here we are on the day before your 87th birthday, listening to some of these wonderful recollections as well as interpretations of what did transpire, and I'm so happy that you are sharing this, as will the people who listen and read the transcript and listen to your words, because it will be shared.
Remarkable. I
came to California, would you share that? I'll just say that. Please share with us another pivotal event when you went from, after you were in England and you came for the first time to California.
I asked my father to speak to the manager of a very large cattle company, which here in San Diego County.
Temecula Valley.
Temecula, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I asked my father to ask the manager of this ongoing cattle operation. If I could ride, that is to say, if I could drive cattle, and the manager, being a friend of my father's, readily accepted that. Not exactly a perspicacious assent. I remember the first day when I mounted the horse. As soon as I put my foot in the stirrup, the horse took off.
Ah.
So you can imagine how I landed on the ground. So one of the men who was employed to drive cattle there came over to me and said, "Well, now look, this won't happen if you turn the stirrup this way and you put your foot in going backwards rather than forwards, and then you can just bring yourself right over."
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I fortunately did go clear over. it taught me a big lesson, and from then on I have never mounted a horse without turning the stirrup around. It was a pivotal lesson,
mm-hmm.
and a timely one.
Tell us how you had been riding. They had you riding all day, and you.
Yes, they had me riding for 11 hours,
oh my.
And I developed a large blister on my calf. Didn't faze them one little bit. Following day, I had to ride again.
Oh boy!
And so.
I learned
a lot from that encounter.
It sounds like you didn't follow the pathway to going on to being a cattle driver.
No.
Tell the story about your first morning at the mess hall.
Oh, yes. About 5:30 in the morning. I walked in with some of the other cowpunchers. And there was on the table, about this high up, a pile of scrambled eggs. See? Well, so we're all eating this, and they wolfed down the whole business, and I was left alone. And the cook came out and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, I haven't quite finished." "Well, damn it, finish!" it was the first time I had ever been in the company of chaps like this. And the cook was angry with me. "Why the hell can't you keep up with these people?" That's one of the strange things about my life. Speaking chronologically,
mm-hmm.
I've gone through a lot of disparate experiences,
mm-hmm.
More so than you would expect. But maybe with respect to higher governance,
mm-hmm.
there was a reason for that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but it was it was a strange feature of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Born in New Zealand, and leaving when I was four for Australia, and living in Australia for 3 years, and then to England, and living in England until I came over here. 4 years after that, in 36. Strange odyssey.
That's very interesting. When I was a little girl, my favorite book was a book called Susan Who Lives in Australia with all of her paraphernalia.
Isn't that lovely?
I remember it was one of the first. I can remember the illustrations, you know, with the kangaroos, and I was fascinated by it. I still have not been to Australia but want to go. Mm-hmm. Did you remember enjoying being in Australia, or do you have any sense of...
Well, I left there rather young.
Yeah.
I left New Zealand, my birthplace.
Yes.
When I was four. And I moved to Australia, where I lived for 3 years, and from there over to England, where I grew up.
Oh, there was something that I think Bruce mentioned about when you were in England, about a park and swans.
Oh, yes, yes. I was fortunate enough to live across one of the main highways, across from Gunnersbury Park. Which had this rather large small lake.
Yeah.
And my favorite bird, the swan, was always swimming around with that air that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Swans are fantastic in the way they bear themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I was always absolutely totally fascinated by the swans. And I would go after school over as fast as I could get across the street to the park to watch them, and they had a strange habit which fascinated me. There was a little bridge
mm-hmm.
In the park, and the swans often left the small lake and traveled under the bridge to some other water area.
Mm-hmm.
And the behavior of them totally fascinated me, because two or three of them would swim abreast, and every once in a while they were swimming, one would turn around like this and grab the other one by the neck. And and hold, and the one that was being held didn't seem to find this annoying.
Hmm.
See, and then after a while, the one that was doing the grabbing let go, and turned back, and went on, and then a little more, and went on and on. And this absolutely fascinated me. I used to love to watch this nonsense. There was something about it that was magical.
Uh-huh.
Why didn't the one who was nabbed make a fuss? I couldn't answer that question. It was strange. The one that was doing the nabbing was very accurate. and the one that was nabbed didn't seem to be put out by this. And I was unable to satisfy myself that I could account for this behavior. So after school, I beat it over to the park as fast as I could so I could see these babies again. Oh, dear. That's one of the beauties of London, is the number of parks, as you know.
That's why I mentioned Gramercy Park, because I've been to London, and I know that's one of the wonderful things about that we tried to emulate a little bit in New York with one little park. No, actually, we have Central Park as well,
right?
Which is really quite beautiful. But it, you know, it was emulating the parks in London. It's just such a wonderful. It helps the city.
It does. It does very, very much.
Well, since you love lambs so much, I'm sure you remember Sheep Meadow in Central Park. Sheep Meadow was right. The beautiful area where, actually, by the time that we were all there, there were no sheep, right? But years ago, there were. And they kept this area right in the middle of Manhattan for sheep to graze. But then no more. But they still call it Sheep Meadow. Yeah, parks are wonderful.
Aren't they?
Yes. And I very, very much have enjoyed sharing this morning and our lunchtime together and with Mary and Bruce and you.
Well,
as
very
well.
Kind. Speaking for myself, I'm so happy to have met you.
Well, thank you. It's very, very mutual. And I know that San Diego State University will be very happy that you shared this time and with everyone. And now we are going to stop. And I have to find the...